From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eight months after the September 11th attacks, the giant pile of rubble that was the Twin Towers is virtually gone, and Ground Zero is now a vast hole. Photographer Joel Meyerowitz received special permission to photograph Ground Zero and document the cleanup efforts. Today he returns to Fresh Air to discuss the photos published in this week's New Yorker. Also, we discuss the future plans for Ground Zero with Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for the New Yorker. And book critic Marian Corrigan reviews Everything is Illuminated, the debut novel about the Holocaust by Jonathan Safran Foer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Election watchdog groups called today for reform of the Federal Election Commission. The groups, which include Common Cause and Democracy 21, say the agency has failed to enforce campaign finance laws. They want the current bipartisan board to be replaced by an independent agency that would be led by a single administrator. The FEC is currently a six-member commission composed of three Republicans and three Democrats. The watchdog groups say the commission frequently deadlocks along political lines, leaving important work undone. International donors have issued a report on the physical damage caused by the Israeli army's offensive in the West Bank. NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
The World Bank and the United Nations announced today that Israel's March and April offensive into the West Bank caused an estimated $361 million of physical destruction in the Palestinian territories. Michael Keating of the UN says the bulk of the damage was not done to Palestinian Authority installations, but to housing, infrastructure, and the private sector.
It's very difficult to understand how some of these the things that have been damaged represent a security threat to the state of Israel or to the Israeli public.
The UN says reconstruction cannot take place unless the Israeli government removes crippling travel restrictions in the West Bank and offers assurances that Palestinian institutions will not be targeted again. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The man who confessed to shooting a Catholic priest in Baltimore on Monday appeared at a bail hearing today. He says the priest sexually abused him years ago. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
26-year-old Dante Stokes told the judge he wanted to see his family and child. The judge denied bail for now and ordered a psychological profile. When Stokes was 17, he went to the church and the police, claiming Blackwell had been sexually abusing him after Bible study classes. There were no witnesses and little evidence, and so the police dropped the case. Blackwell went through treatment and then returned to the church. Years later, Blackwell was suspended indefinitely because of another case of sexual abuse. The earlier case of Dante Stokes was not reopened. Stokes told his family he just wanted an apology and didn't know what came over him when he shot Blackwell. Stokes is being charged with attempted murder, assault, and weapons violations. Blackwell remains hospitalized in serious condition. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Baltimore.
The Catholic Archdiocese of New York says it has changed its policy on handling complaints of sexual abuse by priests. The Archdiocese now says it will report such complaints directly to prosecutors without reviewing them first. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 54 points to close at 10,243 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 6 to close at 1,725. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says that no American soldiers in Afghanistan appear to have been infected with a mysterious fever that's stricken 18 British troops. British officials say the men suffering from the fever are all British medical personnel at the main Allied air base at Bagram. Two of the British soldiers have been evacuated for treatment in Britain and Germany. Attorney General John Ashcroft wants a constitutional amendment that would give crime victims more rights. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles reports on Ashcroft's speech in Columbus.
Ashcroft says crime victims should have more rights. He says that's why he's backing a constitutional amendment now being considered by Congress.
And this amendment would provide specific rights for victims of violent crime that would be protected under the Constitution, so that when the crime victims' rights collide with the perpetrator's rights, the courts have the capacity to balance those rights to make sure that victims are not always found on the short end of the consideration.
Ashcroft says crime victims should be given more choices. For example, observing executions or, in some cases, looking at or hearing evidence. For NPR News, I'm Joe Ingles in Columbus, Ohio.
Insurance investor Martin Franco pleaded guilty today to more than 20 federal charges of fraud and racketeering, in which he allegedly stole more than $200 million from small insurance companies. Franco was returned to the United States last year from Germany, where he'd been held since fleeing the country in May of 1999. He was accused of stealing cash from insurance companies he controlled in Arkansas, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The cleanup of Ground Zero is nearly completed. Only people involved with the recovery effort have been allowed on the site, but my guest photographer Joel Meyerowitz has been able to get unlimited access to document the transformation of Ground Zero. Meyerowitz has joined us a couple of times to talk about this work. We invited him back to discuss his photos in this week's New Yorker, spanning from September 23rd through May 1st. His entire collection will be given to the Museum of the City of New York. The State Department has sponsored an exhibition of his photos, which toured around the world. And in August, some of his pictures will be on exhibit in the lobby of 195 Broadway on the periphery of Ground Zero. Well, Joel Meyerowitz, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to describe a few of the photos in this week's edition of The New Yorker. Why don't we start with one of the photos that you took just, you know, at the end of September?
Thanks for having me back again, Terry. That fold-out picture is a two-part panorama. That was the first night I spent down at the site, and it was the night that I met the team of detectives from the Arson Explosion Squad, who ultimately became my guardians down there. And they were so excited by this potential project of mine that they literally carried my equipment and me up 9 flights of stairs to a rooftop of the Dow Jones building. And there in front of me was this extraordinary image of the center in heaps, piled everywhere, with stadium lights on it, mysterious in its brilliant shine and its dark pockets and smoke coming out of it. And it was a scene, you know, I couldn't have ever conceived the amount of damage, the strewn about quality, the collapsed, almost elastic look of all of the metalwork as it draped itself over the building. In fact, the building in the foreground was a 30-story hotel that had been reduced to the size of what looks like a couple of buses. And it's just completely entombed in this metal. I took it in two different parts, trying to weave it together as a kind of faux panorama, because I felt the site needed this expansiveness to try to comprehend everything that was there.
On November 15th, you took a photo inside a daycare center right across the street from the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Tell us about this photo.
The making of it first, I mean, getting into it was something that was incredibly scary. Every day I would pass a flight of escalator steps that had been frozen at that moment and completely covered in dust and paper and refuse. And it always beckoned to me. And for some reason on this day, I thought, I'm going up there. I guess I heard they were going to tear that building down soon. And I made my way upstairs, and there, instead of a door, was a huge window that had been destroyed. And in the window, I saw cribs, lots of infant cribs piled up in a corner. And it was as if a huge hand had swept them aside. And it probably was the force of the wind that came roaring through there. And as I walked through this place, I saw all of the hasty retreat signals that were left there, like the kids' knapsacks were hanging on the hooks and their lunch boxes were in places, everything covered in dust. And then I came to these little cars lying on the floor, And they looked so much like a scene you would see from an aerial perspective looking down. In fact, one of them's an ambulance. If you look at the side, you could see a little red cross in the shadow there. And I thought, how strange. I mean, it's this scale displacement. Was I on top of a building looking down, or am I standing here looking at something at my feet? And then I noticed in the dust there were some masks, and there was a little castle cut out. And there were a few footprints there, almost the kind of footprints you see when you see NASA photographs of the moon. Those footprints are left in the dust forever. In this case, of course, forever was 6 months and the building was torn down. But it just struck me as a kind of miniature of the thing that happened on that day.
Another photo of yours in this week's edition of The New Yorker. It's a column from the South Tower, which you say will be the last piece of building to be removed from the site. Has it been removed already?
No. This is, their plan is that on the last day, when all else has been carted away and raked clean, this tower, this column will be taken down, covered in flags, put on a flatbed, and everybody in the site will accompany it out of the site and take it to, I'm not sure about this, but they said a barge, and send it to wherever it goes. But there's a few stories about this I think you might be interested in. I was down there the other day, and since I took this picture, people have come down and written their fire station numbers on it and their rescue service numbers, etc. And then people who've lost sons or friends have begun to put their photographs up. And the other day, I was down there, just last week, and I saw one of these sites that's almost mythic. I saw two men, an older and younger man, walk into the place, now it's a pit, actually, where the column is. And the younger man got up on a little perch of concrete at the bottom and tried to put a photograph up. And he got it partway up, but it wasn't high enough for him. And the old man backed in and knelt down with his back to this guy and then pushed him upward on the column. He just used the force of his body as he began to push against the column and upwards. And he lifted this younger man up another 3 feet. And the guy put up the photograph and taped it around and everything. And I ran over to see it because it looked like this mythic connection of, you know, two men together. And when they came down, I spoke to them. And they were a father and a son, both firemen, and they had lost one of the other family members, another son. And they were putting this up there. And when I spoke to him, he said to me, and this is so strange, "We're lucky we found him." And you think, you know, I mean, this idea of they were lucky that they found the body. I mean, they were unlucky that they lost them, but that they expressed it as luck that they were able to find something to bury was so remarkable. The three of us stood there in tears.
The final photo in your collection in The New Yorker this week, your collection of photos from Ground Zero, was taken on May 1st when the pile was pretty level. Would you describe the photo?
Yes, I went back to the same vantage point that I made that first photograph on September 25th. I wanted to see what it looked like from that point of view. And really, it's a vast hall now. It's the bathtub, they call it. And it's almost completely empty. There's a pile of rubble that's not steel rubble, but mostly concrete and earth at the north end. And bit by bit, they're bringing that into these raking fields. They spread out the rubble about an inch or two thick and maybe 40 yards long. And 8 or 9 firemen walk in with rakes and they comb it. It's just this incredible scene, and it's the one continuous image that I have of the World Trade Center recovery. They're still down there, these firemen, leaning on their rakes like shepherds in a field. A new pile comes, and they go, and they scrape away, and maybe they'll find a shoe. And you see them. They pick the shoe up, and they sniff the shoe to see if there's any rot, and maybe there's a toe in the shoe that can be analyzed for DNA, and somebody will have some, you know, relief in a sense. And on Friday I was down there, and it was evening. The shift was over, and they had just laid out a new field, and there were no firemen around. And I made a picture just of this raking field. And into the picture comes a fireman, and he's heading home. He's got a sack on his back and everything. But he sees a rake that was laying there, and he picks the rake up, and instead of going to put it away, he starts raking. It's like he couldn't help himself. And I walked over to this guy, and we talked. His name was Tuli O'Toole. And I said, "It's hard for you to stop." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "That's us, gardeners in the Garden of the Dead."
Oof.
These men, I mean, so often have a kind of poetic nature about the work that they're doing. And they do it ceaselessly and with such devotion, because they want to find every last, you know, possible remains, so that when the site is completely shoveled clear, they know that they've done everything they could possibly do.
My guest is photographer Joel Myritz. We're talking about his ongoing documentation of Ground Zero. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Joel Myritz, and he's been documenting Ground Zero ever since September. And several of those photos are printed in The New Yorker this week. His entire collection will be given to the Museum of the City of New York. And through the museum for about 3 to 6 months, he's going to have a show just outside of Ground Zero at 195 Broadway in the lobby of the building there. And that will begin probably sometime in August. Joel, I know, like, just after September 11th, when we were all watching the images on TV of the destroyed World Trade Center, it was just impossible to imagine the site ever being cleared of so much rubble and so much steel. What's it like for you to look at Ground Zero now and see it basically cleared?
It's the strangest feeling, Terry, and I know I'm not alone, because I speak to so many men down there who've been there the whole 8 months. There's a strange feeling of nostalgia. That time in September and October was a time of incredible commitment on the part of all these volunteers and workers down there, and the pile was so enormous that to attack it made you feel as if you were incredibly useful and you were doing something that was for, you know, the public good. And it had elements of, you know, a heroic effort to associated with it. And now is this emptiness, and there are, you know, trucks buzzing around and getting the last bits of stuff out. And it does feel like there's a kind of longing for that moment when we were all brought together to do something that was going to set things right.
Have you been to Fresh Kills, the landfill where so much of the rubble has been taken?
Yes, I've been out there a few times, and it too is an astonishing collection of things, because...
Well, this is a huge garbage dump, one of the biggest in the world, I think. And
right.
And added to it now is the debris of the World Trade Center. What did you see there?
And oddly enough, that landfill was closed a year ago by Mayor Giuliani. We had finally filled it up, and then this happened, and they had to open it again. And when you go there, it's as if they took the elements of the site itself and they cataloged them. So it's like a library of images. Over there are all the fire trucks, 98 of them, stacked up, one on top of each other or next to each other. And then there are the ambulances and the police cars and the EMS vehicles and private cars. I mean, everything is put in its place, except periodically you see a crazy juxtaposition. For example, there was a Rodin sculpture of a standing man, a beautiful, famous Rodin sculpture. The man is standing, and he's probably leaned over in a way. So he's made a gesture, almost a sorrowful gesture. And this was probably in some office. It's bigger than life. And it was destroyed in the fall of the buildings. And there was the Rodin sculpture lying on its side. And next to it was a piece of the airplane. And they were just dumped together as if, okay, metal work that's not buses and trucks goes over here. And I came upon it, and I saw this rotor blade or something circular from the airplane. And next to it was this lying figure on the ground, almost as if it was sleeping. I mean, incredibly powerful and strange.
Are there any things that you have saved as relics of the World Trade Center?
Yes, I have a couple of really astonishing things. I have a piece of folk art. The welders who are down there, the burners they're called, they doodle all the time. When they're not busy cutting things down, they often find a piece of metal, and they'll doodle drawings in it with the torch. And I have a piece of the World Trade Center. It's probably 16 inches long. It's a part of an I-beam. And the guy has drawn in it the World Trade Center, both of them, with the antenna. And then out of the beam, he cut a gigantic cross which goes over the World Trade Center. It is a piece of naive art that is so beautiful in the directness of its making, the immediacy of its drawing. And I'm going to be giving that to the Museum of the City of New York, and hopefully it will travel with this exhibition. And the other thing I was given, just the very same day I made a photograph of the column we were talking about before, a fireman came over to me and said, "Hey, Joel, I think you should have this." And it was a big piece of metal, I would say probably close to 2 feet. And it was oddly shaped, you know, uneven all the way around. And welded to it by heat and pressure was a Bible. And the Bible was torn open, and pages were missing, and it had been burned and soaked along its side and covered in dirt. It was found 6 floors below ground. And the page that it was open to was the sermon, "An Eye for an Eye." Hmm. And he said, "I think you should have this." And he handed it to me. And it's an artifact, you know, that was seared together by the heat or the pressure.
What'd you do with that?
I dried it out, and I've boxed it up, and will ultimately display it with this exhibition. And there are lots of other things. I mean, as I went, I found nuts and bolts, huge ones, and a gigantic set of keys that were all mangled, and a piece of the airplane. I have a small piece of the airplane I was given by somebody. And lots of little things that have come up. A workman's bag that has some old tools in it and some pinups. I mean, all crushed and covered in dust, you know. But somehow they have a poignancy to them because they were ordinary things that were, you know, just ripped out of their surroundings and then buried. You have no idea where they fell from. Oh, and there was one key that I found that had a little slug on the back of it, and it said, "World Trade Center, do not duplicate."
Hmm. Your experience as photographing Ground Zero must have made you feel so much closer to New York than you even felt before.
Oh, I feel, I mean, so connected to the outcome of this. I mean, I really feel like I want to have a hand in it somehow. I've marched over that site for so many months that I feel I know it intimately, and I would, you know, I wish there was some way I could be part of the, you know, the consideration of the development of the site.
What kind of memorial would you like to see there?
Well, one of the things that's come to me, from this effort of walking around and around the site is the real scale of it. You know, if you say 16 acres, it's almost hard to imagine what 16 acres is. But if you walk it just as an ordinary human being on the street, you get a sense of the pedestrian scale of it. And I've been thinking that a memorial might be a forest of perhaps 3,000 trees, one for every victim of the World Trade Center. In fact, I was thinking if there were 80 people from England, there should be 80 pine trees come from England and 60 from Russia, 40 from Italy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think of it as a pine forest meandering through the site so that it would give off its fragrance and its oxygen, and it would be a living memorial, and that each tree could be assigned a name rather than some plinth with a name inscribed in it. Wouldn't it be something to have a tree that you could go to and sit at the foot of and have that tree represent your parent, your loved one, so that there was a way of connecting? And in fact, there was a map printed in the Times a few months ago that showed, ghastly as this may seem, the distribution of bodies. It was wherever they found clusters or individuals, they marked it on a map. And I was thinking, couldn't that be, to some degree, the way one would approach this as a kind of a site work or a conceptual work, planting the trees in the clusters where they found the bodies so that it moved throughout the site around whatever buildings were there and created this green space that wasn't just formalized in a rectangle between two streets, but as something that moved and lived in the space and that marked the drama of the destruction in some permanent way.
Well, Joel Marowitz, thanks for talking with us again. And, thank you for documenting Ground Zero for us.
Thanks for inviting me again, Terry. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Several of Joel Marowitz's photographs of Ground Zero are published in this week's edition of The New Yorker. His collection will be given to the Museum of the City of New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the future of Ground Zero and the New York skyline, we talk with Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Everything is Illuminated, the debut novel by 25-year-old Jonathan Safran Foer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ground Zero is now a vast hole. The cleanup is nearly complete, but the future of the site is still a big question. My guest, Paul Goldberger, is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. His article in this week's edition is titled Groundwork: How the Future of Ground Zero is Being Resolved. He writes that the rebuilding of Ground Zero has forced us to rethink that section of Manhattan and gives us a chance to fix some of the mistakes that were made at the time the World Trade Center was built. I asked him what mistakes he'd like to see fixed.
Well, the World Trade Center represented really the sort of apotheosis of a certain kind of 1960s planning and design, which you might sum up as saying it believed in replacing the complex, interesting, rambunctious mix of things that constitutes the city and a good, vital urban neighborhood with a huge, dull, big, flat thing. We obliterated a whole section of Lower Manhattan for the 16-block superblock with just two huge, simple, clunky towers dropped on it. So correcting that is one of the things that I think there's already a pretty wide consensus would be a very good thing to do, putting back some sense of the cityscape, a feeling that you could actually heal the city in so doing. Then another one of the things that we hope can be corrected there isn't really a World Trade Center-related mistake, or not totally. There's a whole web of different kinds of transit systems and subways and commuter lines and so forth that come into that area. None of them were ever connected properly. They were built at different times for different purposes, and you could pull all of that stuff together and maybe do a great transit station, like a Grand Central or, if you want, 30th Street Station for Lower Manhattan for the 21st century. And that's a wonderful opportunity as well.
It looks unlikely that another mega skyscraper will be built in the place of the World Trade Center. Why is that unlikely?
I don't think anybody wants to occupy a 110-story building at this moment in our history. And even less likely is the possibility that anybody would want to pay for it. So the bankers who often make the real decisions about what happens in our cities are not going to finance a building like that because they fear too few people would actually want to occupy it. And I think they're probably right. At this point, it would be a building that nobody really wants to have an office 100 stories above the street in precisely that place where this terrible thing happened on September 11th. However, there's a lot of talk now, and I'm very excited about this, that we should try to find some way to heal the skyline in a different way. For those people who were lucky enough not to have lost members of their own family on September 11th, the thing that they seem to have felt most acutely was the loss of the skyline, the sense that the skyline, which is really the icon of New York, was broken and shattered in a way that it had never been in history. And putting back something into the sky, reclaiming the skyline, is a really important mission that I hope can somehow be part of the rebuilding process. What I would like to see happen is a great tower, a broadcast tower, an observation tower, that would be a kind of Eiffel Tower of the 21st century and maybe could use our technology now as aggressively as Eiffel used the technology of the 19th century to create a beautiful and very advanced object that became a symbol of that city.
Paul, I know in the age of terrorism, nobody wants to be on the 100th floor in a building on the site of the World Trade Center. But even without that, was the era of wanting to build the tallest skyscraper ever over?
We really hadn't been building super tall skyscrapers, mega skyscrapers, as I call them, for a while. You know, there's only one building in the United States was taller than the World Trade Center, and that's the Sears Tower in Chicago, and it was finished in 1974. Since then, we've kind of lost interest in that. They're not terribly economical buildings to build. They're difficult. They tend to work mainly as icons. And it's not a surprise that the whole business of building super tall buildings moved over to Asia to those places like Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and Shanghai that are trying very hard to be noticed on the world stage.
The economics of renting a building like that must be really difficult, too.
The economics of running or renting, did you say?
Well, of running and renting, making a building that size function without losing a fortune.
Well, it's difficult. The problem with a super tall building, it isn't the engineering. It isn't getting it built. We've been able to do that for many, many years. We could build 150 stories, 200 stories even. The problem with super tall skyscrapers is once you get above about 80 floors, the necessity of having so many elevators to get people to the top floors means that most of the bottom floors are taken up with all the elevator shafts going to the higher floors. So you're spending an enormous amount of money to put up this incredibly complicated steel or concrete structure to go higher and higher and higher, but you're getting relatively little space because you're using up so much space at the bottom with more and more elevators. And as I said, the sort of calculations that sort of tilt at about 80 stories, and it generally doesn't pay at that point.
Who's in charge now of deciding what the future of the site will be?
In a way, I'm tempted to say nobody's in charge or everybody's in charge. It's enormously complicated right now, the whole question of the future of the site and the politics of it. The person with the most authority is the governor, George Pataki. He created something called the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, which is a state agency charged with overseeing redevelopment there. The Port Authority, which is the bi-state agency shared by New York and New Jersey, which built the World Trade Center and continues to own and control the land, has a great deal of authority also, since they have made it clear they aren't going away. They want to rebuild in some form. They believe it's their land. They're going to defend it. And so they're sticking with it. Because the governor has say over the Port Authority, and the governor has say over the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, he's really the person with the most power. Oddly, the mayor has very little power here. It's mostly a state-controlled piece of land. It's a curiosity because people associated the events around Ground Zero so intimately with Mayor Giuliani because during the weeks following the terrible events of September 11th, he did oversee most of the cleanup and rescue work because that was done by city employees, by the fire department and the police department, which reported to the city. But the future, in a way, belongs to the state, not the city.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Paul Goldberger, is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. We're talking about his article in this week's edition titled Groundwork, How the Future of Ground Zero is Being Resolved. After the Oklahoma City federal building bombing, the families of people who died had a lot of say in deciding what the memorial to the people who died would be. And I think that a lot of the families of people who died in the World Trade Center attack want that same type of participation. Can you compare the two, what happened in Oklahoma City and what families are hoping for now?
Well, Oklahoma City is the most comparable thing in American history, certainly recent American history, to September 11th. But, in fact, it doesn't really offer us nearly as much help as we might think. It was a tiny event by comparison. 168 people died as opposed to nearly 3,000. It was a small site, and it was an easy matter to devote the entire site to a memorial. The only possible thing that might have happened in Oklahoma City along with a memorial would have been a new federal building. But the federal government said it was perfectly happy to build its new building a block or two down the street. Didn't matter. There was plenty of land. What did they care? So the entire site was turned over as a memorial. And there was great pressure from the families of those who died to become not just involved, but to really run the process. And in Oklahoma City, there was a key moment when a man named Robert Johnson, who was a very distinguished local lawyer who'd been put in charge of the whole thing by the mayor, was asked by the families to guarantee that they would have the majority of the votes in a jury that would determine a memorial. And he agreed to let them do that, which infuriated one of the men who had been hired as their professional advisor, saying that, who essentially said it will mean nothing but kitsch and we will have, you know, terrible memorials of, you know, statues of angels and things like that and nothing that has real dignity to it and it will be sentimental and trite. And he walked off. In fact, things didn't turn out so badly, in part because in Oklahoma City they were smart enough to have created a series of guidelines in advance that assured that the memorial would have a certain amount of dignity and not be hopelessly maudlin. In New York, though, we have a much, much tougher situation, and I don't see how we can work within the process they used in Oklahoma City. We've got to have an ongoing part of the city there. It's almost impossible to imagine that the entire site could or should be devoted to a memorial. Not only would it create a void in the center of one of the busiest business districts in the world, it would, in a way, allow that site to belong in perpetuity to the terrorists. We think that leaving it all empty honors those who died, but in a strange and unintentional way, it also gives control of the site to the terrorists. And if you think that what the terrorists were trying to do was destroy the ongoing life of New York, and indeed the ongoing commercial life of America, then building that back on this piece of land is in fact one of the most appropriate responses that we can make.
You've mentioned a couple of designs for a memorial that would be incorporated into office buildings. What are some of the other memorial designs that you've heard that would stand independent?
So far, there have only really been a few pure memorial ideas. I think the people who are the most thoughtful, such as Maya Lin, who designed the great Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, are not rushing. In fact, Maya Lin was asked what she thought we needed at the World Trade Center, and her answer was time. She said, let's wait. Let's not do anything too quickly. And I think she's right. I think we do better when we absorb an event of this enormity over time and think about it. Most of the designs that people rushed into in those first couple of months were not terribly good. They were honest outpourings of emotion and passion and feeling at a terrible time, but I don't know that they would have really solved the problems that we need to have solved. I mean, a huge statue of a fireman is a lovely idea, but is it really what we want to see in the middle of Lower Manhattan? I'm not sure. I haven't yet seen the memorial that feels right to me other than the idea of a great tower. But I think that's fine because, in fact, the sort of call to the international community of architects to begin thinking about it and submitting ideas hasn't really even officially gone out. Everything that's been talked about has been kind of self-generated and is a little too soon.
You wrote in The New Yorker that you hope that whatever is done, it incorporates shards and pieces of steel and twisted remnants of the face of the World Trade Center.
Yes, I would love to see that happen. There's a great power to ruins. We don't always think about that in this country because we have such a short history. We don't have a lot of ruins. We've been lucky enough not to live through much war here, and we don't have cathedrals going back to the Middle Ages. We don't have thousand-year-old buildings. We don't have a lot of ruins. In fact, ruins can give a kind of resonance to a city that's very, very deep. And I think nothing would be better than to see the pieces of the facade that were saved. They're not there now, but they've been, in fact, preserved and dismantled, and they're being stored, re-erected there as a reminder of what was, and that sort of twisted, broken aspect which tells you so much. And there's an authenticity to the power of ruins that, particularly today, in an age of the virtual, when we're so unaccustomed to seeing things that are real, I think the power of the real object can be very, very convincing and meaningful.
While you've been keeping up with the plans for a memorial and for office space in the site of the World Trade Center, have you been also seeing a lot of, like, kitsch memorial? I mean, stuff whose heart is in the right place, maybe, but it's just kind of really tacky.
Well, there was a lot of that proposed for Oklahoma City, and there's been a certain amount of that here. Happily, though, a lot of the impulses toward that have been deflected into the sort of private memorials people have done on the walls, the fences, the mementos, those where people put messages or objects or relics and things like that. And that those things collectively really become a kind of great work of public art and transcend the kitschiness about them. It's a delicate business. Everything about it is very delicate, you know, because there were those who objected to the viewing platform that was created for the public off-Broadway so that people could actually stand there and observe the site, thinking it was ghoulish and vulgar. And in some ways, it sort of is, and yet people also want to bear witness to history. And most people come to it, I think, with the right, earnest, honest impulse to stand there in tribute and to look as a means of respect, not ghoulishness. It isn't like people who think it's funny to watch an execution or something. I think people are coming after the fact out of respect, and most people have come in the right spirit. But of course, it's a very fine line, and I understand why to some people, particularly some family members, it has seemed to be over the line to do anything at all. It's tough for these people. Not only has their entire life and family life been turned upside down, but it's been in such a horrendously public way. And they have no place to go that's theirs, no private place. The site belongs to everybody, which, as we've been saying, is in some ways a good thing. It's created an enormous outpouring of passion. But for those people who lost husbands or wives or children, how do they feel different and more marked than you and me? We all have a stake in 9/11 and that piece of land, but do the people who lost their family members have a greater stake? They certainly have a greater level of feeling, and they have a greater right to feeling and passion than we do. Whether they therefore also have a greater stake in the land going forward is a tough question, and that's going to be one that nobody wants to address head-on. I think the political forces are sort of sidestepping it as delicately as possible, because nobody wants to say, yes, they have a greater stake in the future of that land than the rest of us do, but nobody wants to say no either.
Well, Paul Goldberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Goldberger is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. His article about the future of Ground Zero is in the current edition. Let's listen to a track from the post-9/11 compilation, Wish You Were Here, Love Songs from New York. This is pianist Uri Kane.
Thank you.
pianist Ori Kane playing New York, New York. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the debut novel by Jonathan Safran Foer. This is Fresh Air. Everything is Illuminated is the title of the debut novel by Jonathan Safran Foer. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says the main character of the novel has a gift for making even the most depleted subjects fresh again through his skewered way with words.
Jonathan Safran Foer sure has chutzpah. Not only does he write a novel about, of all daunting subjects, the Holocaust, but he does so in a crazy postmodern patchwork quilt of styles that dares his readers to keep on their toes from paragraph to paragraph, lest they slip into bewilderment. And get this, the guy is only 25, and this is his first novel. Everyone who takes books seriously is talking about Everything is Illuminated, not just because this experimental phenom of a novel was written by an apparent wunderkind, but because the story Foer tells is uniquely affecting. There are certainly fictional and historical accounts of the Holocaust that feature more extraordinary personalities, or even more appalling acts of barbarism. Foer's novel, however, is the first Holocaust story I've ever encountered where the technique of the narrative itself is what's so poignant. As this already chaotic story approaches its climax, its great illumination, it breaks down into fragments of collective diary entries, bad jokes, religious textbook mumbo-jumbo, editorial corrections, letters, and blank pages. It's as though, stylistically, Foer's novel is uttering that great Samuel Beckett line, "I can't go on, I must go on." If I'm making Foer sound too melodramatic, let me also add that, like Beckett, he's irreverent and ironic and serenely brutal as a writer when he needs to be. The relatively straightforward, if resolutely non-chronological, main narrative of Everything is Illuminated is told by Alex, a very young Ukrainian man with a slippery grasp of English. Alex is called into service as a translator when a character named Jonathan Safran Foer shows up at the travel agency that Alex's father works for. This fictional Jonathan, an American, asks to be taken to the little town of Trockenbrod in order to find the woman who saved his grandfather from the Holocaust. Because the travel agency is short-handed, Alex and Jonathan set out across the farm plains of the Ukraine with Alex's own grandfather as their driver and his gaseous and drooling dog for protection. The trio finds an impossibly old woman living near the field that was Trockenbrod. "I am it," she tells them, meaning not that she's the savior of Foer's grandfather, but that she contains the town in boxes of photographs, wedding rings, junk that she salvaged after Trockenbrod citizens were murdered by the Nazis. Rooting around in one of those boxes, she unearths a photograph not of Jonathan's grandfather, but of Alex's. And therein lies another dreadful wartime tale. Married to this contemporary book of revelations is a more whimsically grotesque story about the origins and 200-year-old history of Trockenbrod as imagined by Jonathan Safran Foer, the character. As you might expect, this storyline owes much in tone and substance to the work of Jewish magical realists like Isaac Bashevis Singer. But for all its technicolor hallucinations about, for instance, a baby who miraculously bubbles up from her drowned mother's belly, and a mill worker who survives an industrial accident with a disc saw neatly embedded in his skull, these old-world fables pale by comparison to Alex's present-time narrative and the wacko vocabulary that shapes it. Apologies to Desi Arnaz, but the comic potential in fractured English usually expires after about two jokes. Here, however, we readers never know whether Alex is going to hit a funny bone or an unexpected illumination with his irreverent and unintentionally poetic use of English. In Letters to Jonathan, written after their shared adventure, Alex describes himself as a premium person who admittedly has been very nomadic with the truth. It's a tribute to Alex's captivating voice, as well as to Four's daredevil literary impulses, that we readers pursue the crooked path of Alex's sentences to their bitter, ungrammatical conclusion.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D., now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, traveling with an elite Israeli commando unit in the West Bank, we talk with journalist Scott Anderson. His article was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.